Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey you, do you need some spice in your life? Well, this Valentine's Day, why not arouse your special loved one with a sexy Brexit-themed night to make sure you never go back to a single market? Nothing will make your withdrawal agreement happen quicker than making absolutely no plans and then insisting your partner should have done it, and it's only because they won't have faith in you that you fail to do anything special at all. To really get things going, try whispering in their ear that you're thinking of alternative arrangements for their backstop. Insist on using technology to create frictionless borders. Try tying them up to remove their freedom of movement and saying you won't charge them if they choose to come early. Then, to end the night, why not pay 11 people a lot of money to turn up and agree with everything you say? Then, demand access to fishing waters and just keep trying the same thing over and over again, but telling your partner it's definitely something new and different in the hope that they'll just give up and leave so you can trade goods with others who don't know you and aren't interested. Remember, this Valentine's Day, Brexit means sexit. So get it on with the kind of special night that will cause the pointless destruction of an otherwise happy union. Hello and welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, the podcast that asks if the term politics means the operation of a constitutional system of government, then which surgeon did the operation in Britain? Because I think they've sewn it all back up wrong. This is episode 130, I'm Tiernan Duyeb, and this week, as President of the European Council and William H. Macy's grumpy twin, Donald Tusk, said that he's been wondering what the special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without a plan of how to carry it out safely, I'd like to step in and say, that is an awful and ill-thought-through comment. I mean, we all know that they won't go to hell, they'll be stuck in a forever purgatory as bad place officials pointlessly argue for infinity about what to do with them. Donald Tusk's comments caused upset in many Brexiteers who either knew he meant them, willfully misinterpreted what he said, or are such xenophobes that they heard his foreign accent and switched off before he'd finished. A number of Conservative MPs said the statement was insulting, unlike, you know, all those comments many of them have made about the EU being like Hitler or the Soviet Union. I suppose the issue is that those are all elements of real-life history which they don't understand and haven't bothered finding out about, whereas Tusk was talking about hell, a fictional place that exists only within certain beliefs, and that's far more the personal ballpark of extreme Tory Brexiteers. It is mad to think, though, that with only 46 days to Brexit, there is still no plan. I mean, I've gone on last-minute holidays that required more prep than this, and the one time I forgot my passport, I didn't try to blame airport security for not believing in me enough. Prime Minister and human cramp Theresa May visited Northern Ireland last week to explain to business leaders that there was no suggestion of removing the backstop, just that she wants to change the wording. Great, I mean, that's reassuring and not at all concerning that maybe the wording will now just say there is no backstop. I mean, it's a bit like saying that you don't want to have your dog put down, you just want to find a way to stop it still being a dog. May then went to the EU to meet with Tusk with no new proposals or ideas because, you know, if you keep throwing shit at a wall, eventually you lose your job as a sanitation worker. I'm not sure why I use that analogy as May doesn't dispose of waste, she just endlessly keeps retrieving it and bringing it back for inspection like a very ill dog. After Brussels, May then went to Dublin, as if she'd already convinced herself that that's the route it'll take to get between Northern Ireland and the Republic post-Brexit. And then she met with Irish Taoiseach and Employee of the Month at Carpet World, Leo Varadkar, and the two made absolutely no breakthroughs, but they did eat some beef together. Yet another moment that proves Brexit is some sort of prime event that means it's only ever able to be a metaphor for itself. The only actual signs of movement last week on Brexit at all, surprisingly, came from Labour leader and several woodland creatures all standing on top of each other in a suit, Jeremy Corbyn, who set out the five terms under which his party might support May's deal. So that's not the previous six tests that Labour had that May didn't remotely pay attention to. It's a whole new five terms that happen to sound like five of the six tests. And then once she ignores those, Labour will probably come back with four really important points and then three things you might like to know about, followed by two post-its that I'll pop on the fridge so you might see them before you leave. And then finally, here's this one thing that's got me tripping as they all flail around to Amory's only hit. The EU told May that Corbyn's suggestions could offer a promising way out of the impasse, but the use of the word promising probably made the Prime Minister assume she didn't have to keep any of them to make things work. She's already rebuffed one of the five terms, which was Labour's call for a customs union, criticising Corbyn for wanting a say in future trade deals instead of the UK's ability to strike their own. Yeah, Jezza, I mean, why can't you have faith in our ability to strike all those deals like we've already done with, the Faroe Islands. Yeah, look at that. I mean, we're all totally sorted for a diet of, puffin meat and Viking metal. The UK also now has a deal sorted with Switzerland, so that's quite good, and that will keep our current trading relationship with them for after Brexit, because I suppose rather than just putting ourselves down, it's easier to make plans with a country that specialises in assisted suicide. As is always the case, the other group to have a problem with Labour's five terms is, of course, Labour, as Shadow Brexit Secretary and stylised webtoon Keir Starmer was shown a draft copy of Corbyn's letter to the Prime Minister that included the threat that if she didn't agree to them, Labour would back a second referendum. But that threat was missing from the actual letter, and Corbyn's office said, "Oh, we must have forgotten that paragraph." Nothing says government in waiting than either actually forgetting a party policy or pretending you have done. I can't wait for a Corbyn government to try negotiating with the EU with such tactics as, "Oh, sorry, I can't attend that meeting after all as I'm washing my hair," or "the guidelines for ECJ jurisdiction during the transition period. Yeah, we did that, but the dog ate it." May has welcomed further talks with Corbyn on alternative arrangements for the backstop, just not any of the ones that Labour have already suggested. But it does make sense she needs new ones when you see the ones that her own MPs have suggested, so far including disgraced MP Liam the Disgraced Fox, who's pushing for a super technological maximum facilitation border with technology that includes facial recognition to deter dissident terrorist groups, because the one thing they definitely won't do, based on previous evidence in Northern Ireland, is wear balaclavas, you stupid twat. The rest of the government's Brexit preparation is going brilliantly, with Seabourn Freight, the ferry company that had no ferries, and terms and conditions copied from a pizza delivery firm, losing the £14 million contract with the government. Now, that could be because Transport Secretary and one of Clive Barker's rejected ideas, Chris Grayling, he's so useless that he's basically only in the cabinet to make everyone else look less shit. Or it could be that the pizza terms and conditions only gave Seabourn 30 minutes to deliver, or they'd have had to give them money back. It's most likely the former, though, as failing Grayling is so awful that he's no longer welcome in Calais after the port's chairman called him disrespectful. I love that we have a transport secretary that's banned from going places. I hope this keeps happening and Grayling's barred from all modes of transport that he's messed up during his terrible, terrible career until he's reduced to just standing in a corner shouting apologies at a tricycle. Meanwhile, Defence Secretary and haemophobic vampire Gavin Williamson has been getting all excited like a small boy with some new plastic war figurines and started banging on about how the armed forces have to be prepared to use hard power. You know, that hard power, as opposed to the soft power that they sometimes fire from their pine freshener room fragrancing guns. It's the sort of language that makes me certain he has a profile on uniformdating.com. He referred to Brexit as a moment when we must strengthen our global presence, enhance our lethality and increase our mass. It sounds a lot like he's planning to do a year abroad where he just eats a lot and murders someone. It was revealed that the Brexit department spent over £45,000 just printing 1,300 copies of May's deal, which most people read online and is now irrelevant because she's on Plan B. I suppose it's still the same. Anyway, it does mean that if we have a no-deal situation, there will definitely be enough loo roll to go round. Labour MP Luciana Not Part of a Meal Deal Burger was given a vote of no confidence by her constituency Labour Party over her disloyalty to Jeremy Corbyn, which was then withdrawn due to accusations that it was actually done because of anti-Semitism towards her. Typical Labour, they can't even decide amongst themselves why they don't like each other. Labour have said that they've looked into 673 cases of anti-Semitism since last April. But I mean, they obviously waited till Easter to do it, which is pretty offensive, huh? Huh? No, I don't know what I'm doing either. The Daily Mail, aka the press version of a wastepipe, printed excerpts from a biography of Corbyn called Dangerous Hero, Corbyn's Ruthless Plot for Power, which seemed to suggest that Jezza is such a megalomaniac, you know, of the kind that spends 40 years doing his job before being surprised that he's elected party leader. Terrifying. Classic driven dictator move. Some of the stories printed about him involved him eating cold beans, not reading many books, refusing to go to palaces in Europe due to them being royal, and collecting a lot of crap in his garage. All of which, when read in a Danny Dyer voice, just sound really laddie. Yeah, I'll neck them beans, books, yawn mate, palaces, double yawn, here's my massive man drawer full of shit, bosh. To be honest, I doubt Corbyn's any less qualified to be in charge than May, as I'm pretty sure she has a cold pulse most of the time too. In other news, France recalled its Rome ambassador after, well, I guess they'd just forgotten him for a while. But it comes as part of a bigger trade of verbal blows between France and Italy in a crisis that's been brewing for a while but was escalated recently when Italian Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the Angry Birds, Luigi Di Maio, went to meet the French protest group the Gilets Jaunes, who have been bringing cities to a standstill in France for 3 months now in protest against fuel costs and austerity. Is it because now Di Maio's party Five Star are part of the Italian government that they can't rail against their own establishment anymore, so they have to challenge other countries? Or was it that his Italian sensibilities meant that he heard about a bunch of people starting a trend of fluorescent clothing and got very excited? Work and Pensions Secretary and only person whose default expression is a head teacher who's heard about how you let your class down, Amber Rudd, has admitted that the rise in food banks is linked to failures of universal credit. This is an amazing admittance from a woman who's usually only at her best vaguely aware of anything, so that is exciting. But she has also said that it's only one of the causes, and this is a woman who as Home Secretary wanted to ban encryption because she didn't understand it. So let's not get too excited that suddenly the DWP are turning over a new not-disablest leaf, as it's more likely that if Rudd doesn't work out exactly all the other reasons why food banks are needed, she'll try to have them deported. Eroded no face mask and Conservative MP Christopher Chope blocked a law to protect young girls from female genital mutilation, in yet another example of him doing exactly what everyone expected him to as part of his endless mission in life as an enemy of women. Dinosaurs have been draped over his door in Westminster in protest of his decision, but I think it would just have been better to pop his face on a load of women's underwear as a very effective form of protection from any harm or unwanted attention. And lastly, sentient ingrowing hair bump on a slimy scrotum, Nigel Farage, has formed the Brexit Party, which will supposedly sweep the country, though that could be because it'll be Farage's only vocational hope after he loses yet another election. They don't seem to have a tagline yet, but Nige, may I suggest for your party, don't vote us in, vote us out. You're welcome. Yeah! Hello, Parpol Broads, what is happening? In my house, it's mostly no sleep, and we've now hit the point in parenting where I'm so exhausted, I just do things like I keep putting things in the fridge that shouldn't go there, like my daughter. Not good. But other than that, I've just had a lovely, lovely weekend of gigs, including a superb one in Canterbury where I had to drive there during Storm Eric, who is a proper windy bastard. They closed one lane on the motorway due to a house falling on a witch. True story. And then I had a very nice work in progress mess at Leicester Comedy Festival last night. It was Sunday night for those of you listening later in the week. So thank you to those of you who came to that and basically witnessed a very tired man have a gradual breakdown over the hour and were somehow lovely about it. Trying new stand-up out is genuinely tricky in that you need an audience to do it, otherwise you don't know if it works. But also you feel very sorry for the audience that took time out to witness what is definitely unfinished rambly nonsense. So it is hugely appreciated when people come to these things. I'll be honest, I wouldn't have gone, but sadly I had to be there, which was a shame for everyone. There are no Valentine's things happening in this home this week, as firstly, I think it is an awful marketing ploy that seems to suggest you should only express your love for someone one day of the year, which is silly and way too often. Am I right? Ha! Psych. But secondly, we're also just way too tired for any of that. And I have to be in Leamington that night, which isn't very romantic at all, but it does have a royal pump room. We were way more excited about Pancake Day, but it turns out this year it's in March. What the fuck? What the fuck? How did that even happen? Who even has pancakes in March? What kind of weirdo does that? But it's fucking Brexit. Fucking Brexit. Oh, what am I talking about this week? It's just abject nonsense. I hope, you know, you're having a lovely Valentine's-y, non-pancakey week. What I should be talking to you about is you and your sexy ears and how you are lovingly using them to suck in this show. Okay. I'm going to stop that. This is really... I just stopped the Valentine's shit. Okay, thank you for listening. That's what I meant. And this week, thank you very much to Rosie, who donated to the Ko-fi site, which you can do too at ko-fi.com/parpolebro. And you can do monthly or one-off payments there. Exciting. So many varieties. What would you like to do? Or you can go to the Patreon... which, I mean, no one is anymore. No one goes there. No one visits it. It's going to be one of those sort of relics that we'll look back in 20 years and wonder how it's still up there. It's like the Space Jam website, just, you know, slightly more useful to me. Anyway, but do go and have a look at it, even if you don't want to donate there, just because I made a video for it a few years ago that's still there, and I was quite proud of. So, you know, make sure that isn't completely wasted money. Anyway, patreon.com/parpolebro. Obviously, if you can't afford to donate or you just don't want to give me any money because, you know, I'll likely spend it on something stupid, then please do review the show on whichever pod app you use, or, you know, just tell that special person in your life to listen to this podcast too. Otherwise, what kind of sham relationship is this shit? If you're single, why not put a pic of this podcast and a link to it in your Tinder app? And no, look, I'll be honest, I have no idea how any of that works. Is that a good idea? Would that work? Would people just try and screw this podcast then leave? I'm so old, none of it makes sense to me. What does make sense is that the Kids Politics show that I do and I plug on this every single week starts again this week, so I am plugging it again this week. That makes sense. So on Wednesday, 13th of February, we are at The Place in Bedford at 6 p.m. Then on Saturday, 16th of February, we're at G Live in Guildford at 2 p.m. And then on the 22nd of February, we're at the Lighthouse Pool. And then on the 23rd, at the Gulbenkian in Canterbury. There are times for those, but they are far enough away that I'm trusting you to Google it. You've got time. Just do that. So if you have small people, age 6+, and you want to watch myself and Tatton Spiller from Simple Politics absolutely panic about how to describe Brexit to them, then do come along. It will be a lot of fun / slightly panicky. Okay, so this week I am speaking to Dr. Jessica Garland from the Electoral Reform Society all about citizens' assemblies. Plus, there is Brexit fallout. Oh, God, I'm so sorry I've killed the mood, haven't I? Can we start over? No? Okay, well, look, why don't... Well, I'll just turn over and why don't you just entertain yourself with a bit of this then? Norfolk Police are hiring untrained non-cops on zero-hour contracts to, well, police low-risk crimes. I mean, yeah, that sounds fine, right? I mean, because of all the police cuts, I think it's totally legit that someone could pop a hat and a badge on in between delivering kebabs to stop someone stealing a bike, well, probably their own bike that they've inadequately locked up in between jobs. Norfolk Police have had to cut all 150 of their police community support officers. You know, you remember them? The toy police that used to walk around when there weren't enough proper ones around because, you know, cuts? Well, those ones have now also been cut, as Norfolk Police's budget dropped by £5.5 million last year, so they really haven't had much choice, and cutting PCSOs has saved them £1 million. So, they've got all inventive, and they're hiring what they like to call scene guards. Yeah, it does sound like they'll mainly be protecting theatre props and nice views, but actually, they're going to be standing around watching crime scenes before accidentally running their bike through one because someone's ordered a curry. The job application says applicants need the ability to maintain concentration for prolonged periods and experience of dealing with confrontation, so I'm pretty sure loads of post-Edinburgh fringe comedians will be eligible. Admittedly, some of the money that Norfolk Police have saved has also gone on proper officers too, which is really good, but this very much feels like the beginning of a scary run of police cuts and privatisation, which will, as we all know, end up leading to an Uber driver ruining a crime scene because the victim lying in it didn't give him a star rating. And then it'll be Ed 209. End scene, guards. A bit of nice-ish news this week. I can do this very briefly, but the Stansted 15 were a group of protesters who chained themselves to a plane to stop it deporting people to Africa, something that is both awesome and hardcore in a kind of Tom Cruise maybe doing that in Mission Impossible 7 at some point way. Despite doing immense good, they were arrested for endangering the safety of an aerodrome under legislation that was meant to be used to combat terrorism and hijacking, which they weren't doing. I mean, they were doing the opposite of hijacking. They were very much keeping the plane exactly where it was. Yes, what they did was dangerous. Yes, it did cause the runway to be closed for an hour and 23 planes to be diverted, but hey, that's still less annoying than a drone. Anyway, it looked like they could all face hefty prison sentences, but the court just gave 3 of them suspended jail terms and 12 of them community orders, which, to be fair, I'd say they'd already done by saving those people. And 3 of the people that they'd saved that were due to be deportive have now been granted leave to remain, and one man has remained with his family that he was going to be separated from, so that's amazing. The Stansted 15 have said that they'll appeal against their convictions too on the grounds that it has implications against freedom to protest, which the Court of Appeal could ignore to make a point, but hopefully they won't. Either way, it's a pretty great pardoning and condoning of what they did, and further proof that the Home Office is just deporting people willy-nilly without any good reason. Plus, I'm really looking forward to the Stansted 15 film, where Tom Cruise plays everyone. Absolutely everyone. Keeping with the really tenuous Valentine's theme of this week's show, do you know what gets me really aroused? What do you mean you really, really don't want to know? Okay, all right, fair enough. But what I was going to say was democracy. I mean, it doesn't, but, you know, it said it was tenuous. I mean, hey, sure, sex is good, but if you tried a democratic system that actually allows for the informed voices of the public to be heard, considered and debated, leading to actual political change, it can't be done. Well, no, not in the UK right now. No, it can't. Now we're currently indulging in a system where those in charge are supposedly representing the will of the people. It's just that it's only certain people, most of who are in the same party as them, and some of whom I'm not 100% certain are people. Our first past-the-post voting system in the UK has been in force since 1884, and it's arguable, as we're doing daily sighing over safe seats, deadlocked parliament, and, well, Christopher Chope still having a job, despite not having accurately represented anyone's views for at least 100 years, it's arguable that maybe, just maybe, we need something else that fits today's democracy. Now look, I've met a lot of people, and sometimes I'm not always sure that it's wise to give them a say, let alone a vote, when they can't even indicate when driving or understand what a joke is. But citizens' assemblies seem like a genuinely good idea. No, they aren't just when members of the public get forced to sit cross-legged in a hall while some six-year-olds read them a poem about harvest time. Instead, citizens' assemblies are a way to allow citizens of a place to have an educated debate that leads to actual changes in society. Sounds good? Correct. Possible way forward for society? Hopefully, if anyone can ever remove Theresa May from Number 10 without having to use Loctite remover and some pliers. They are very much something that I'm interested in, though, and so this week I spoke to Dr. Jessica Garland from Electoral Reform, who conducted a citizens' assembly in 2017 about Brexit. And she's part of a team who are constantly exploring new ways of doing this democracy lark. Jess very kindly let me ask her all about what they do, how they work, will people be interested, and if I can still read my poem about harvest time called, hauntingly, Reap What You Sow. Okay, I didn't ask her about the last one, but we did have a very lovely chat. I hope you enjoy. Here is Jess. So, I mean, obviously, UK democracy needs something happening at the moment. I think a lot of people are aware of that. Is that something a citizens' assembly? And, I mean, really, I should ask you, what is a citizens' assembly and how does it work and where has it worked before?
Well, a citizens' assembly is typically a group of around 50 to 200 citizens. It kind of depends how large the area is that you're trying to represent. And they're selected at random to get together over maybe a couple of weekends to discuss an issue, usually constitutional issues. And what they'll do is they'll have a phase where they hear from experts, learn about the issues, then there'll be some debate, usually in small groups, you know, so everyone gets a chance to contribute. They're usually facilitated, you know, to make sure that everyone's heard and no one's kind of talked over the top of, and then they get through the issues, then they have time to deliberate on them, talk to them with people who may have different views from them, and then come to some recommendations. Sometimes there's even a vote at the end to get to a kind of fixed position. And they've been used all over the world, in British Columbia, on the electoral system, in Iceland. They had a big constitutional convention looking at the whole of the constitution. And more recently, in Ireland had a convention on the constitution over 2 years, and then that led to a citizens assembly which looked at a whole range of issues, and most recently and probably most in the news on the issue of the Eighth Amendment on abortion.
As you say, that sounds incredibly civilized for a start. And also, so when you say that they hear from experts, they're given a full rundown, like how much knowledge are they given about the subject?
As much as necessary. And actually, in the case of the citizens' assemblies in Ireland, they then asked for more evidence. So on the abortion citizens' assembly, they wanted to hear from women who had either decided for or against an abortion, and they really wanted to hear from people. So that's another really useful, a great benefit of the Citizens Assembly, is that you can actually hear from people experiencing those issues firsthand. So they heard, you know, obviously from medical professionals, and then they themselves requested to hear from people who had a personal experience. So a whole range. And of course, who you select is very, very important. You know, these have to be, particularly on issues that are very tense and contentious, you have to make sure you're being balanced and that you've selected a whole range of people to share their views. And of course, in some cases, then you have people who are actively campaigning on either of those issues come and talk to the groups. It all depends. You can do it in a number of different ways. But of course, you've got to be really, you've got to put a lot of thought into who you're going to invite along to give that evidence.
So which poses the question of how do you find people for that? I mean, is it if you've got to be careful, it can't just be a random selection, but then how do you make sure that you've kind of got a broad enough cross-section of people?
Yeah, so in terms of the participants, you really want to go for, you know, a sample of the population. So that's, you know, mixed along gender, age, race, social background, you know, all those really key factors. And when we did our Citizens Assembly on Brexit, we, of course, wanted to also reflect the Brexit vote. So we had, you know, the proportional numbers of people who had voted leave or remain or hadn't voted. And again, in terms of the experts, we wanted to have both kind of academic opinion, you know, economists, but also people from both of those campaigns as well.
I mean, that sounds amazing. That sounds I wish the country had had that access. Your Citizens Assembly on Brexit was in 2017, was that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is that, I was going to ask you, is that what's needed now? There obviously isn't really time for that to be done now, but it feels like we're at a real stalemate with Brexit. Do you think a Citizens Assembly would help push things along? I mean, definitely access to information would.
Yeah, and that's a really big question, because there's lots of different ways of doing a Citizens Assembly, and lots of people are kind of mooting the idea at the moment, but sort of suggesting slightly different versions of it. And going back to 2017, our Citizens Assembly we were involved in looked at, you know, the decisions being made about Brexit, how then would you implement it? So, you know, it was sort of accepting of the decision, how do you take it forward then? And so the citizens in that assembly looked at kind of options, obviously, around trade and freedom of movement and things like that. Time is absolutely crucial. I mean, our Citizens Assembly met over two weekends, but you know, you also need a lot of time in planning it. Also thinking about what exactly is that Citizens Assembly consulting, and what are they deliberating on? You know, is it the whole question of Brexit? Is it something broader, actually, as Gordon Brown has been suggesting, issues of sovereignty and you know, people's sort of place in society, those kind of broader issues. So loads of different kind of suggestions, but I would say time is absolutely the crucial thing here. You can't rush these processes, and also you can't really throw a Citizens Assembly just into a really divided and kind of polarised issue like we have at the moment. I think that could be quite damaging. So it does need a bit of time. It could really add to the debate, you know, sort of informed deliberation, really help people, kind of help us move on to next step. But also, you know, we do need to be careful about this to just sort of launch into something because the other things have failed, I think could be quite damaging, you know. So because people have to really have faith in the process, faith that it's being well set up, that it's been even-handed, you know, and also, you know, that everyone's got to say, okay, whatever comes out of this, we're supportive of it. So, you know, in that case, people can't be thinking, oh, this is just something for Remainers or it's just something for Leavers. You know, it's got to bring all sides of that debate together.
Oh, God, which sounds impossible. I mean, it does sound like a much, better would be the wrong word, but I mean, definitely quicker and perhaps more efficient than, say, a second referendum, which is going to take months to sort out, to put together a Citizens Assembly, were people to give gravitas and importance to the result of that, then I think that does sound very sensible. I mean, do you feel like, has Brexit opened up more discussion and debate about UK democracy and how voting and representation works? Because it really feels like we're in a very stalemate parliament at the moment, and in the last election was the first time we start to see changes with safe seats, but it definitely feels like there's, I don't know, it doesn't feel right at the moment.
Yeah, and I think I think people are looking at Parliament in perhaps with a different pair of eyes, or perhaps feeling. I mean, the difficulty, I think, is that people are probably just looking at Parliament saying, oh, politics is just, you know, failing here and feeling let down. And I think there's a real risk of turning to a kind of sort of anti-politics kind of frame there. But I think, you know, I'm looking at Parliament now and thinking, look, this is exactly what you get from, you know, Westminster system, you know, from a politics that doesn't do collaboration or consensus or kind of coming together and, you know, bringing people along with you. You know, this is the sort of politics you get when, you know, policy is made by pushing legislation through with the minimum number of votes. You know, what the whole Brexit process has been lacking is any kind of engagement, any kind of sense of, you know, let's bring people along, let's try and work together on something. And of course, we're at the sort of nth hour now, and, you know, that people still aren't sitting down together and saying, okay, how can we work together to do what's right for the country? And I think people are seeing that. What worries me is then it turns into a kind of anti-politics, but politics doesn't have to be like that. You know, there are better ways of doing things. And I think we need to really look, whatever happens with Brexit, really take time, take a pause, and really look at our politics and how it's working and not working.
I mean, in some of the examples you gave earlier about when citizen assemblies worked, for example, in Ireland, obviously the one on abortion then led to the referendum. But how have other governments kind of taken the results of a citizen assembly? Because, I mean, one of my concerns would be that, and I won't point any fingers, I mean, it's a very non-partisan comment if possible, but I feel like people very much want to hold on to the power that they have in our government at the moment and in our politics in general. How do you persuade them that members of the public should have a very direct say? You know, how has that been taken on board with in other cases?
Yeah, and those are the big questions for when you're setting up this sort of process, is how binding are the decisions that are made out of that citizens assembly or convention? Where do they go next? Does it always go to a referendum? Is the result of that referendum binding, or is that, you know, referendum purely kind of indicative of people's, you know, viewpoint? And there's so many different ways. And of course, you know, it's easier to persuade politicians, I would say, of just having a kind of non-binding indicative kind of vote on these things. But for citizens to engage in them and give up their time and really, you know, put a lot of effort into it, then I think you have to have some sense that the conclusions of that assembly are going to go somewhere. So it's definitely a balance there. But I think absolutely crucial, and what we've really been lacking definitely with the EU referendum, with previous referendums, is a really well thought out kind of timeline of what happens next. You know, at what point does this deliberative process or this direct mechanism fit into representative democracy? Because deliberative democracy isn't a replacement for representative democracy. It's something that kind of enriches the debate and enriches the decision making. So you've got to think, well, how does it fit in? And that's a jigsaw puzzle that you kind of need to think about before you launch into the process.
Sure. Yeah, they need to work alongside somehow in an ideal world, I suppose. I mean, one of the other areas that I know that you've worked on quite a lot is participatory budgeting, which sounds absolutely fascinating to me, because that is obviously giving quite a lot of power to citizens' decisions. How does that work? And again, does that not remove more responsibility from the government if people have got, you know, the ability to allocate funds themselves?
Mm. Well, we haven't actually done any participatory budgeting ourselves, but this is, you know, part of the kind of, you know, scope range of different deliberative mechanisms that you can use. It's really common in South America. It started in Brazil, actually, I think, in the 1980s. So it's been around a long time and works at a kind of more local level. And we're certainly doing some work in Scotland with the Act As If You Own the Place project, you know, working with local communities on what they want to see for their area. And, you know, when you get down to that local level, you people really do engage in democracy and decision making in a way that perhaps, you know, they don't at the national level, because Westminster can seem quite remote. People don't have the sort of same connection. And, you know, but when you get down to the local level, there's huge scope for involving citizens more in the decisions, which, you know, the decisions which affect what they see on a daily basis. And you find, like, huge level of engagement in that kind of work. And does it remove responsibility for government? Well, it kind of depends. I guess at the local level, you know, there's more immediate decisions to be made. And when you involve citizens in them, you know, you're likely to get a better decision and one that kind of more reflects the community you serve.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we'll be back with Jess shortly, but I mean, look, it's this bit again. And I would say I'm sorry, but I mean, it's not my fault, is it? I didn't do this. Trust me, if I could replace this section with just a favourite political pancakes to have, including suggestions for a flapjack Brereton or a Mary Crepe, but, you know, it's not till March, is it now? I mean, it's not even in this month. What the fuck is the point? Also, those are the only two pancake politician ones I have, and Mary Crepe Creep. It doesn't really even work. Yes, it was a shit idea. All right, OK, let's have this bit then.
Brexit fallout!
Yet again, I could just spend this section just playing you audio of me throwing cutlery into a bin while a sad dog barks, or the sound of someone repeatedly walking into a glass door, and really, you'd be all caught up on where things are with Brexit. Actually, that's not true, as there is one major change over the past week, and that has been Labour's Brexit stance. And yes, I know that it's probably already changed by the time you hear this, and yes, probably now it's changed again before I finish this sentence, and then Shadow International Trade Secretary and Scottish David Brent, Barry Gardiner, will say something else entirely on 12 different politics shows that he's somehow on all of in one morning. But look, for now, Labour have presented these five terms, which if May agrees to, and she hasn't, I mean she's already rejected one, but if she maybe agrees to the others, then we might begin to see a vote for her deal that will actually go through. And it's a big mite. It's larger than a dust one. It's more a sort of house-sized mite. But it's possible, as it's clear, that very few MPs want a no deal. So, Labour's terms are, number one, for a permanent and comprehensive UK-wide customs union that includes a say on future EU trade deals. Now, look, already this one's pointless, as May has said no, and there is no chance the EU would let the UK have a say in their deals when we've left. I mean, it's a bit like one of my old flatmates repeatedly trying to pop in my house and shout what I should have for dinner. No, fuck off. But certain centrist Tories agree with the overall idea of a customs union with the EU, and it would solve the Northern Ireland problem pretty quickly as well as protect a lot of manufacturing. So you never know. If someone accidentally hoovers up a bit of May's red line or falls over it and it gets knocked out of shape, maybe this could sneak in. Number two is for close alignment with the single market, which is in May's deal, but the EU said it was cherry picking, which is impossible as we're not going to let the people who pick the cherries into the country anymore, apparently. So either it's a full-on single market and then blam, freedom of movement comes back, or it's a no-no to this. But again, if it's in May's deal, it may allow that to pass Parliament, which then means it can go to the EU and then get rejected again. And we're starting from the beginning. This is 46 days ago. Holy shit. Number three. Now, this one, May is expected to go for. It's a dynamic alignment on rights and protections so UK standards keep pace with evolving standards in the EU as a minimum. The Prime Minister is supposedly going to add a guarantee for this in her bill, with what's known as a regression lock, which, yeah, sounds just a bit like they're going to make sure that everyone's going to have adult baby tantrums about it. But actually, it means workers' protections will never go below EU ones. And yet, it's vague how far Labour want this to go. Like, how many workers' protections do you want? Does that involve safety standards? Air quality standards? What about lifeguards? Hadn't we better keep the beach cleanliness standards, as otherwise they'll get a rash like I did from the sea and market in 1986? What about grocers? We don't don't want them handling any dangerous vegetables, so we better keep all the EU's vegetable standards. And what about vets? We don't want them near any dangerous animals. May as well keep the EU's animals. I mean, you sort of get the idea. Number four, this one is about commitments on participating in EU agencies like Euratom. Do you remember that from last week? Good times. No, Euratom. No, Euratom, etc, etc. Oh, good times. Also, the medicines agencies and the education ones and that one that we worked with to build that satellite that we now won't use. And there's so many more. That EU, they've got so much agency. Anyway, you can pay money to be part of these, and countries in the European Economic Area are part of many of these, but they don't have a say. So it's something that could be done and in many ways should be done, but we might be sat at a table while everyone else decides who a Tom is, except us, and my flatmate will keep popping in to tell you what to have for dinner. Number five, the last one is all about security arrangements and having access to the European arrest warrant databases and basically being able to see which crims are where across the continent. Shock, they're all in Spain because we let them go there to open sports bars. No, I mean, this is an important one, but the EU have already said that they couldn't share the same access as we had unless the UK accept EU data protection laws and the rules of the European Courts of Justice. So it depends what's more important to us. Sovereignty of our courts, which I mean we've always had, or knowing exactly who stole the Pink Panther and where they are. No, I'll be honest, I don't really know what it's used for. Something like that. May is speaking to Parliament tomorrow, aka just after you hear this or before you hear this, or exactly as you hear this, because you multitask like a pro. It's not clear how many, if any, of these terms she'll accept, but as I said, the one on workers' rights might be a go. It's far more likely that May is going to announce a delay in presenting her plans and then ask for more time, because, you know, I mean, there's loads of that, right? Just help yourself. Gorge yourself stupid on time. Why don't you just fill up another plate with hands and seconds and minutes? Some of those 60-minute meals, there's bloody time everywhere. Just it's big old time. There's fucking 46 days left. All this does is count down the clock, which could mean it's all pressure on sorting something out, or it could mean a no deal, and that looks like now that it could mean a united Ireland. Yes, as well as the question of Scottish independence coming back up, it now looks like a no deal or even a bad Brexit deal could lead to an Irish referendum on reunification between the Republic and Northern Ireland. Now, hey look, I'm all for unifying things that are meant to be together, you know, like peanut butter and almost anything sandwiches, but it sort of ruins the whole Conservative conserving thing if the United Kingdom just crumbles. And I'll be honest, I'm slightly worried about Wales will be stuck with its least favourite parent forever. But we will have to wait and see. One thing that is pretty clear, though, is that as time is running out, ministers are suddenly rushing through tons of legislation with no one having a clue if any changes have been made. These are statutory instruments, and long-time listeners may remember me barking on about these a while back. No, a statutory instrument isn't, say, a cello made of stone or one of those lute sculptures of Cupid's play. It is instead an executive order on pissy little things, and as a result, they don't usually need House of Commons approval because it just takes up your time. But with so few days to go till March 29th and a need to get 600 statutory legislations passed before then in order for Brexit to happen, who really knows what's being added to them? I mean, it's all being done in small committees of Conservative ministers who've got very short amounts of time to look at things that took years to create, and there's absolutely no transparency in what's happening. They could just be being signed off, or they could have bits added to them. I mean, we don't know if, say, the Road Vehicles and Non-Road Machinery Amendment now says, for example, by the way, no one in Labour's allowed to use a car or they'll get hit in the face by a shoe. Or how from now the Equine Records Identification and Movement might say all SNP members will be recognised as horses. Or whatever. I mean, it could be weird shit. No one knows. 117 are done, 40% are still to be put in front of Parliament, and we've got no clue what's in any of them. So, 46 days to go, bags of time, eh? And there's every chance at the end of it the Alcoholic Liquor Duties Act 1979 will have been changed so you can only have booze if you voted Tory. And Ireland will be Giga Ireland, a mega Ireland, which includes not only Northern Ireland, but also they'll have claimed the Isle of Man and Anglesey as both sought asylum. In the meantime, May will have only decided to take every fourth word of Labour's terms, Labour will have said that's fine because they're too busy insulting themselves to care anymore, and the EU will have turned out all the lights and just instructed everyone to say they aren't in if Theresa calls. Ah, I'm sure it'll all be fine. And now, back to Jess.
I guess, with the simple thing of I know the issues in my local area where I live and what really needs to be immediately fixed, and that's the same around the country. Things that they might feel are being overlooked by a larger, you know, by the national government because they don't have time. They can allocate funds immediately to fix, like potholes, for example, which always is a big contentious issue. Potholes or bins or all those sorts of things, you know, and that must be quite satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just being able to sort of feel like you can have some influence on the stuff that's happening on your doorstep, be that a pothole or a bin, you know, and also, you know, that you've already got an understanding, haven't you, of your local area and the people you live with. And I think that's really, really important. You know, it helps people engage in politics at a level that's kind of meaningful.
I mean, that sounds... I love the sound of this, and I think one of my personal concerns, I mean, this is a very selfish question to ask, really, but you know, the way in which the public interest in politics it's grown recently, and it's grown a lot with Brexit, it's grown a lot with the Scottish referendum. Before that, it was very apathetic; people didn't seem to really care, and voting numbers were low. I mean, would a more involved democracy like this, do you think it would keep people engaged? My selfish concern is that where would people have the time to take part in all of this? Doesn't it require you to kind of have a lot of extra time to go to meetings, to work on all these things? You know, how do you kind of allow for people's busy working lives, really?
I think that's a really good consideration, because of course with all these things you want the people involved to be, you know, representative of everyone in society, so you don't want it just to be people from one particular group who have more time than others. So I think that's a really it's an important consideration. I think also you've got to think, well, what are we asking of people? You know, is this a one-off thing or is this a regular thing? You know, with a regular thing, it's quite difficult to find the time and stay engaged. You know, there are places where, you know, referendums are, you know, really, really regular, you know, and you see the turnout for those as, you know, down in the sort of 40% often. So, you know, there is a risk that people turn off, you know, if there's too much of a burden. But of course things like participatory budgeting is a once a year thing, so I think there's definitely a balance. When it comes to the large scale constitutional conventions, these are definitely not once a year. These are once in a generation kind of decisions, and I think people feel a real sort of pride in getting involved. And you know, there's that, it's an opportunity to be part of something really big, and I think, you know, people often, you know, grab that with both hands. And of course, you know, again, how you set these things up is really important. Often participants are paid, you know, so that you're not excluding people who would find it a financial burden to go along, and you, childcare arrangements, all these other things should be put in place, so you're getting a true cross-section of society at the convention.
Yeah, I mean that's huge. That's hugely important that care is in place, because I mean just having the freedom to be able to go and not worrying that suddenly it's meaning that you're losing other work. But I guess like you said as well, that I think I think one of the reasons that politics has gained interest, not just because things are particularly crazy, but those referendums were about big one-off issues, and people suddenly thought maybe by voting on this it will change things in a way that means something. And that was, I mean, you know, that's fascinating to see what happens when people think that their vote might actually make a difference.
Yeah, and hasn't it just been so long since people have felt like their vote has made a difference? You know, just we would obviously say, you know, there are huge parts of the country where in general elections people feel like there's no point in them turning out to vote, you know, where they're in a safe seat, they're not seeing their vote reflected in the outcome. And of course, you know, along comes a referendum where, you know, you've got a really direct say, and it's absolutely great that people are inspired then to take part, but it shouldn't be a one-off. You know, you shouldn't have a once in a generation chance to make a difference. These should be things that happen, you know, all the time in democracy. People feeling like actually getting involved goes somewhere, you know. And that's why deliberation is kind of better than just consultation. You know, consultation is saying these are our ideas, send us back some thoughts on them. Deliberation is being right at the heart of decision making and really feeling like, you know, your contribution is part of a really important process. And I think that's something that we need to do more of, really. Just get people more engaged, make people, you know, give people real choice and, you know, real decision making power.
And do you feel like, you know, that I mean, British politics in particular, do you feel that that things are more open to these kind of changes now? I know we discussed earlier with Brexit that there's various different ideas being juggled around, but obviously in the UK we had the vote against alternative voting in 2011, which was supposedly a once in a generation vote on the future of voting. Are we now in a situation where we could see something like that come up again? You know, how likely is any of this to happen? That's my desperate hope, you know, desperate for hope question.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, what was that, 8 years ago, and like what an 8 years it's been in politics. You know, I don't think anyone would have seen us in this position right now 8 years ago. I mean, I know every generation goes, oh, this is the strangest thing that's ever happened to politics, and it's just because we don't remember or weren't around for the previous crisis. But but yeah, it does feel like this is a real turning point for politics, and I do think there's two roads to go down. There's the one you mentioned, which is that people look at politics and think about how we can do things better and how we can improve things. And then there is the closing up shop, regressing back to that kind of comfort zone of the tribal Westminster style politics that feels more familiar. And of course, a lot of the changes to our politics over the years have come from being part of the EU. So there's a kind of, I guess there's a risk that sort of the models that we've been sort of slightly moving towards are going to kind of go backwards. So I think there's different routes. There's a way we can say, okay, this politics hasn't really served us very well. Let's find a better route forward. Or there's the kind of, let's just go back to the Westminster system with, you know, the strong executive, the majoritarian system, most people's vote not counting. And, you know, that for me, I think would be a very backward step.
So are we going to persuade politicians first or people first, or what's the next step?
Both, hopefully.
That's easy then.
I've spent a lot of time talking about consensus and bringing people along with you. So I think the right answer to that is bringing everyone along with us.
Brilliant. And I wanted to ask as well, that before I started the interview, you're mentioning that Citizens Assembly now is working on a campaign about campaign regulations, which obviously is hugely, it was hugely important really 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but it's obviously it's still a big issue in terms of we've seen a lot of questions come up recently about funding and advertising of campaigns. So can you tell me a bit about what you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, so ERS, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about second referendums and potentially even another general election. What concerns us is that, you know, the last few contests we've seen, our electoral laws have been exposed to being like massively out of date. The main rules governing how we run elections are 19 years old now. That's kind of pre-Facebook. So we know that as campaigning moves online, and there's like many positive benefits to that, there's actually also a risk that our campaign laws are just not keeping up with that development. And you know, there's been a lot of concern about mis and disinformation, about foreign interference, about just this whole online sphere being unregulated when it comes to political campaigns. You know, there's really strict laws about what you can post through someone's door, but nothing to say what you can and can't post on someone's smartphone. So we're just saying, look, let's have think about this. If we will have another general election at some point, we may even have more referendums. You know, let's get our law up to date so that we know that those contests are fought fairly, because at the end of the day, it's really damaging for democracy if you have general election referendum and people don't feel that was fought on a fair basis. You know, and that's also about, you know, making sure we've got all the regulations around where money comes from and how it comes into the system are sorted out as well. So we've just had a report out last week where we've got lots of academics and other think tanks and politicians from across the political spectrum, as well as the regulators, sort of saying, look, we really need to do something about this now. So we're really keen that we don't have an electoral contest where people start to question the outcome, because that is really, really bad for democracy.
And I mean, just I realize this is probably probably too big a question for what was going to be the end of the interview. But I mean, technology moves so fast, and as you say, that the electoral rules are from 19 years ago, which I hadn't realized they're quite so old. Do you think there's a danger that technology is always going to be a bit quicker than our government? I guess it would require a sort of almost yearly update in order to be kept on top of it.
Well, I think the technology definitely changes and will certainly always be, you know, several steps ahead, but the principles don't. You know, the principles of, you know, citizens knowing who's contacting them, if they're contacting them from a political campaign, you know, having a principle of fairness, so one political outfit can't spend 10 times as much as another. You know, these sort of basic principles about fighting a fair fight, that they remain the same. So it's just a question of having legislation that can, you know, set some broad framework principles and that applies to, you know, any new platforms that come along in future.
God, future-proofing, wouldn't that be amazing?
Future-proofing.
Yeah, it would be incredible. I dream of the day. Two last questions, really. And one is the very important, how do people get involved in Citizens Assembly? How do they get involved in, you know, what the best ways to spread the word and get people on board with this idea? And the other question is something that I ask everyone, which is simply that other than yourself, what other campaigns and writers would you recommend that listeners look up if this is what they're interested in, if they want to find out more about progressive ideas of changing democracy?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me plug our website, the ERS website, where you'll find our petition on campaign regs. So if you think our laws need updating, join us in that petition. And there's also a separate website for the Citizens Assemblies, both the Democracy Matters one and the Citizens Assembly on Brexit, www.citizensassemblies, and that's got details of all our partners in those projects, a range of academics and other organisations all working on this, so do check that out as well.
Thank you so much to Jess for having time to talk with me. You can find the Electoral Reform Society at electoral-reform.org.uk or on Facebook at Electoral Reform Society or Twitter at Electoral Reform. And the link to their petition for a more proportional voting system is on their front page, and it's in the blurb for this podcast too on your pod apps and on the website. The specific Citizens Assembly website is at citizensassembly.co.uk and on Twitter at UK Assemblies. Next week is all about the transparency, or rather lack of, in think tanks. And then after that, who knows? Who knows? Why not let me know who I should be talking to and what about? And big shout out firstly this week to Chris, who recommended that I speak to the Actual Reform Society all about Citizens Assembly. So thank you for that. And also to Matthew, who sent me an amazing list of suggestions, all of whom I'm emailing and chasing up this week. And if you have some ideas for guests too, please drop me a line at parpolbro on Twitter, the Partly Political Broadcast Facebook group, the contact page on partlypoliticalbroadcast.co.uk, or email me at partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. Alternatively, as it's Valentine's Day week, why not plant your suggestion in the form of roses or other stereotypically sexy type flowers like, Venus flytraps, because I guess they snag your flies. It sounds pretty sexy, doesn't it? Anyway, plant all those, and then when they bloom, I'll get your message as I walk past them. Assuming, obviously, they haven't been ruined by cats or slugs, and that's, of course, if they bloom at all with the constantly unpredictable climate change weather. But ultimately, I'll assume that you just want me to interview someone in STEM, which actually isn't a bad shout. It's quite a good idea. Well done, you. Thanks for that. But obviously, it is just much easier to email me. And that's all for this week's Partly Political Broadcast podcast. Tarloads to you. Yes, you. No, not you. You. Yes, thank you for listening to this hoo-ha. And don't forget that if you do like the podcast, please subscribe on your pod apps if you haven't already, and review the show and donate to the Ko-fi and the Patreon, and tell everyone ever, ever throughout all of time, even when they didn't have podcasts, or in the future when sound will be beamed into your eyes because evolution has worked that no one listens anymore, so ears are irrelevant. Just tell all those people, and just tell everyone to have a listen. Go on, do that. Thanks, yeah, to Acast for smuggling these audio peanuts under their sound t-shirt, to my brother The Last Skeptic for all the musical noises, and to Cat Day for the linear liner notes. This will be back next week, when May will have addressed Parliament by giving them exactly the same speech she gave just weeks ago before announcing the backstop alternative of the backstop, which happens to be the backstop. When questioned on it, May will insist it's all brand new material before yelling, "Oh no, it's happening again," and then making a low humming noise and just keeling over. Bye! This week's show is sponsored by Gavin Williamson's Hard Power. Are you sick of all this power that you need being in liquid form or whatever the hell electricity is? Try Gavin Williamson's Hard Power. Solid blocks of power made from raw compressed power and heated over power for you to chomp on, throw an enemy's face, or force through the petrol cap of your car, causing it to need extreme repairs. Yeah, just thinking about this makes me all, yeah, hard power. Hard power. These items are also known as batteries and may be dangerous to ingest, throw, or force into a vehicle. Please don't give your hard power to a child or animal or defence secretary, who certainly is now super fast because he's got your trainers.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.